This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Eye-popping, jaw-dropping, I'm out of words to describe the tsunami of agencies and experts admitting our troubles are bigger than our brains. But this week, we're going to step back from the brink. I want to explore what it means. Who can assemble the currents of climate change, peak energy, and a delusional economy into a big picture? Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, is one of the few who consistently keeps track of all three. I'll start by calling Richard up about a very big new book, and then we'll hear his assessment from a keynote speech at the Great Lakes Bioneers Conference in Chicago. He's the author of 10 books, including The Party's Over, Peak Everything, and The End of Growth. He's also a driving force and senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. You know, I wanted to give Richard Heinberg hell for wasting resources on an 8-pound monster book about wasting resources. The book, Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth, is so big, I had to clear off my desk just to look at it. But then, I got sucked in by 2-foot photos of the nasty industrial mess that is hiding behind our consumer lifestyle, our cars and our smartphones and all that. Why didn't I know that it's so bad out there? So, Richard Heinberg, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be talking with you again, Alex.
Well, Richard, why did the Post-Carbon Institute put all this paper and ink into a play?
The book actually is a project that was brought to us by the Foundation for Deep Ecology. They've produced a series of similar sort of coffee table-sized books going all the way back to one called Clear Cut. It's a strategy that seems to work well because people actually can see, as you say, with big color images, the results for the environment of, basically modern industrial life. And, sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. So these books are always features of activist campaigns, whether it's for CAFO, which was a book that they published a couple of years ago on confined animal feeding operations, or clear-cutting forests or mountaintop removal, coal mining. These books are typically gifted to environmental organizations to use in their activist efforts. So Foundation for Deep Ecology partnered with us on this one and brought us the project sort of half-finished, and then we brought together some of our fellows to flesh out some of the content on energy literacy and so on. And the result is this, as you say, big 8-pound bouncing baby of a book.
Well, I was really impressed. I was struck. I was moved by the photos. And then I began to wonder, well, why don't we see these images in the media or even in our daily lives? We don't encounter this, acres and acres and acres stretching out to the horizon of wrecked land. Do you think the images are censored, or is it because we really don't want to look?
Well, the images are hard to get in some cases. For example, the tar sands in Alberta, everybody kind of knows that, it must look pretty nasty producing that stuff, digging into the arboreal forest and tundra to get this gooey bitumen out that has to then be refined and sent through pipelines and so on. But, unless you rent a plane and fly over, you're not going to really get the full picture of it. Certainly the companies like Suncor that do the mining have no interest in publicizing what it really looks like. So, very few people actually have seen it from a bird's eye point of view. But if you look at the photo in the book, it's a vision of hell. It's a landscape of absolute, complete devastation and destruction.
Yeah, and I didn't realize the vast impact of conventional oil and gas production. Tell us, what is energy sprawl and how bad do you think that is?
Well, energy sprawl is basically the fact that producing energy takes land. And the actual footprint of a conventional oil or natural gas well is pretty small compared to the amount of energy that we get out of the ground. But the problem is we use such extraordinary amounts of energy that, you start putting together oil well after oil well after thousands of more oil wells and natural gas wells, and pretty soon, you know, here in the U.S., we're talking about tens and tens of thousands of oil and gas wells. There are parts of the country where basically you can look from horizon to horizon and see nothing but oil wells or gas wells. And these are places typically where not very many people live. So again, it's not a landscape that most people are likely to see.
And I think if you start driving down those back roads, you might run into a few security cars and people wondering what the heck you're doing there. It's not easy to get to. Well, we should mention there's also a collection of great essays in the book. You're a contributing author. We're going to hear more from you in a speech that we're going to broadcast later in this program. But would you like to talk about a couple of the other written contributors?
Well, sure. We're proud to feature essays from quite a number of energy experts, including Charles Hall, who is one of the originators of the net energy or energy return on energy invested concept, which really transforms our whole view of energy, the economic as well as the environmental costs of energy. There's an essay by James Hansen on coal and climate change. Wendell Berry has a wonderful essay called Faustian Economics, Hell Hath No Limits. There are essays by Jeff Goodell, Sandra Steingraber, who's one of the great activists working against hydrofracking, David Hughes, who is a Post-Carbon Institute fellow, he's a geologist and one of the world experts on hydrofracking and the limits to that technology. Oh, just looking through the table of contents here, Amory Lovins on energy efficiency, Bill McKibben on climate change.
These are all the big names, really, in each field, all writing good essays. And I was taken in the paper by that former CIA director, James Woolsey. He says we're ready to spend billions fighting malevolent groups like Al-Qaeda, but we're unwilling to even talk about what he calls the malignant threats like the system collapse of things, maybe our electric grid or the climate. But Richard Heinberg, haven't you experienced that unwillingness to look or act for years?
Well, sure. Yeah, I've been writing about these issues for over a decade now, and clearly there is a small audience out there, relatively small audience of people who get it, who are deeply concerned. As I put it in my introduction to the book, energy is at the core of the human predicament in the 21st century. Whether we're talking about climate change, whether we're talking about geopolitics, whether we're talking about the economy, energy is right at the heart of it. And yet, here we are in 2013 with basically the same energy priorities as in 1990 or 1980 or 1960. Basically, fossil fuels as our primary energy sources. And we have no plan B. We literally have no realistic energy policy in this country. And the same is true in most countries around the world. We're going in the wrong direction, and we're hitting the gas pedal as we go.
Right. And I noticed in the book, despite the hard-headed figures on world energy sources and things like return on energy investment, which are very important, I was surprised by the photos and essays on the importance of wild places and the species that live there. Is it partly a return to the old environmentalism?
Well, you know, partly that reflects the priorities of our partnering organization, the Foundation for Deep Ecology. But also, you know, I think as society becomes more and more urbanized, it's easier and easier for us just to forget the impact of our activities on wild nature. You know, we don't see as much of wild nature as we used to because so many of us live in big cities. And so, you know, out of sight, out of mind. I think it's really important that we be reminded of the incredible beauty of the places that we're losing at an accelerating rate.
And I notice along those lines, the flagship website and discussion spot for the Post-Carbon Institute has changed from the well-known Energy Bulletin to a completely new site, resilience.org. What does that change mean?
Well, resilience.org is hopefully a much more useful and user-friendly site because you can delve into news and essays in several different areas, for example, energy, economy, environment, food and water, and society. So you can click on any one of those tabs and see, you know, the latest discussion, news, essays in each of those areas. So we are looking at a global systemic crisis that has many dimensions to it. Energy, as I said earlier, is at the heart of it, but even the energy question has its economic and social and environmental implications. So being able to pick those things apart and put them back together we think, really useful. There's also an interactive map there on the site that can take you to organizations in your vicinity that are doing the kind of work that we're helping to publicize and promote around the country, but resilience building efforts, sustainability building efforts, like the transition towns, for example. We have all of the transition towns mapped, but also local food organizations and local energy co-ops and so on.
Well, that sounds really useful. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with energy author and lecturer Richard Heinberg. We're talking about a massive new book called Energy, Overdevelopment, and the Delusion of Endless Growth, just published by PCI. Richard, I want to pose a kind of devil's advocate question, maybe a hard question. This big book of energy explains fossil fuels have powered the boom in human population as well. But at the same time, many of the arguments against some forms of energy, including solar or wind, in the book with the photos, seem to be based partly on aesthetics. The pipes and the windmills look bad. Doesn't that imply we might have to have a lot fewer people if we cut back on fossil fuels, in part to support these aesthetic principles of what nature should look like? Do you see what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, you know, aesthetics sounds so ephemeral. It sounds so she and, you know, like only rich people can afford nice views. So, you know, worrying about how things look is really elitist. But, you know, I think that's a very short-sighted way of looking at the situation. If we continue as we are now, basically all places of natural beauty are going to be impacted. There will be no beauty left. And is beauty all that important? Well, you know, actually, I think it is. I think it's what feeds our soul. It's what makes life worth living. And if we are taking away the very things that make life worth living, if we're scrubbing the environment of all of those elements, then, you know, what kind of legacy is that? Is that really a sign of an intelligent species? So will we get to a point where we must reduce human population? Yeah, I think we're getting to that point. We're at 7.1 billion humans now and marching as rapidly as we can toward 9 or 10 billion. And we're already at the point where we have saturated the natural world with our impacts. If we're smart, one of the most important things we'll do over the course of the next few decades is take population seriously and take steps to limit human numbers.
Richard Heinberg, can people read the essay separately without buying the big book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We will be publishing them online on resilience.org as time goes on. But if folks want to just read the essays, there's no better way than to buy the Energy Reader book, which is basically, it's all the verbal content of the big book. It doesn't have all of the photographs, but it has all of the essays plus two or three extra essays. And the Energy Reader is really designed to be used as a resource for college and high school classes on energy and related subjects, and it is being picked up by I don't have the latest figure, but you know, dozens of sustainability classes and energy classes around the country.
I sure wish it had been there when I went to school. We didn't learn any of this. Let's be frank. I mean, if nuclear is too dangerous, and I think we can agree on that after Fukushima, and oil and gas will run out eventually, that's undeniable. Hydro has its risks. Do you see an energy source available to keep us going safely? And if not, what are we supposed to do?
We have many, many energy sources available, some obviously better than others, some renewable, some non-renewable. The problem is, of course, we're concentrating on the wrong energy sources. We should be using renewable energy to a much greater degree. But, you know, when you really get to the nub of it, the problem is not the energy sources. The problem is overconsumption. We've gotten used to using so much energy that even if we get it all from renewable sources, there are very steep environmental costs to pay. With solar photovoltaic, for example, we're getting energy from the sun, but manufacturing and deploying solar panels on a massive scale has environmental impacts, whether it's from the resource depletion of manufacturing them or the changed landscapes of putting acres and acres of these things, thousands of acres ultimately. Either way, it's going to have an impact. So what we really need to do, the conversation we need to have is, well, yes, about energy sources, but also about how much energy do we really need to use in order to maintain acceptable levels of comfort and convenience? And that's a question so far that we've not been willing to discuss. The assumption is that we have to grow our economy. We have to have more and more people every year living the way Americans do, driving cars on highways and air conditioning their homes and so on. If we stay on that treadmill, it's going to be a very, very bleak future. The only way we're going to get off of that treadmill is to start talking about and thinking about discussing how to use less.
Well, I'd like to start wrapping up because I want people to hear the speech that you gave at the Chicago Great Lakes Bioneers Conference. First of all, are there any websites that you'd like to give out for people to follow up? But secondly, I just want to ask you, what are you working on right now? Is there some interest that you have that you're developing that you can tell us about?
Well, sure. I am working on a new book right now, and it's called Snake Oil, and it's about the current drilling boom in North Dakota and also the shale gas boom. There's been a lot of discussion in the press recently about how this will make America energy independent, how we can look forward to 100 years of cheap natural gas, how the U.S. is new Saudi Arabia, and so on. We're doing some very thorough analytic work at Post Carbon Institute. We've purchased proprietary databases, so we have production data on 65,000 oil and gas wells. And in crunching the numbers, we're coming to very different conclusions. We're looking at decline rates of 60% to 80% in the first year of production for these unconventional oil and gas wells. It looks from where we're sitting like another pyramid scheme. It's another financial bubble like the housing bubble of the mid-2000s, and it's going to end similarly. So this is what I'm writing about. I'm hoping that the book will be out. Well, we're looking at a real fast track for this book, so hopefully by summer of 2013.
We've been talking with Richard Heinberg, one of the thought leaders behind A World Without Fossil Fuels. He's at the Post Carbon Institute and at richardheinberg.com, and he's in the new book, Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. Richard, thank you for sharing your time with us, and I forgive you for sending me the biggest book I've ever owned.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
How do climate change, energy problems, and the fragile economy interact? And which will hit us worst and first? Let's hear Richard Heinberg add it all up at his keynote speech at the Great Lakes Bioneers Conference in Chicago on November 2, 2012. This was recorded for Radio EcoShock by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center. The talk is titled Life After Growth, Why the Economy is Shrinking, and What to Do About It.
Our keynote speaker this evening comes to us from Santa Rosa, California. He's a senior fellow in residence at the Post Carbon Institute. He's written extensively on global energy future, the urgent and unavoidable need to transition away from fossil fuels, and the likely impacts that this transition will have on our food, transportation, and economic systems. Please welcome Richard Heinberg.
I'm going to be talking about economic growth. And economic growth is, as we all know, a good thing. Every politician, every economist tells us so. And in fact, we're told constantly that economic growth has been going on for a long time. It'll go on endlessly in the future, and it always makes us better off. I'm going to challenge all of those assumptions and, in the process, help us see that there is life after growth. First of all, has economic growth been going on for a very long time? Well, actually, no. Here we see world GDP per capita. By the way, that's how we measure economic growth, is in terms of GDP, gross domestic product, which is basically just the total amount of money being spent in the economy on an annual basis. over the last 1,000 years, even as empires rose and fell, there was virtually no change in GDP until we get to the last couple of 100 years. Of course, the last couple of 100 years are also remarkable for other reasons. World population has increased from under 1 billion in 1800 to over 7 billion today. That's just 200 years. So that's an extraordinary rate of population increase. If we saw that in any other species, we'd say, wow, that species is headed for a crash. We don't think that when we see human population numbers. We look at that and we say, oh, wow, how successful we are. A third trend that's related is energy consumption. And energy consumption over these last 200 years has also exploded. Now, I would argue that this third trend is the driver of the other two. And I'll get back to that in a minute and explain why I think that's the case. But before we get there, I want to share with you how I came to have these concerns about economic growth. They actually have roots that go way back. When I was 21 years old, I read this book, Limits to Growth. It was published in 1972. It went on to become the best-selling environmental book of all time. You may have heard that Limits to Growth has somehow been discredited. That's certainly not the case. Actually, it's been the victim of a targeted public relations campaign. What it was, really, was just an effort to use computers to model the likely interactions between population, resources, and environmental damage. Okay, so it wasn't an effort to foretell the future, per se. It was a modeling and scenario exercise. Can we model how these variables are likely to interact over time? So this was the standard run scenario back in 1972, which tended to show a peak and decline in world industrial output sometime in the first half of the 21st century. Now, of course, this was an unwelcome outcome, and so that was the main reason the conclusions were attacked so vociferously. But the primary scientific research organization in Australia, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, CSIRO, did a retrospective analysis a few years ago of the Limits to Growth study, and this was the conclusion they came up with. 30 years of historical data compares favorably with the standard run scenario. I guess the good news there is that we're right on track. We're doing a good job. But this is actually the comparing the trends, the historical trends, with the standard run scenario. And it's a pretty close fit. Obviously, it's not an exact fit, but it's not far off the mark. So where are we now? Year 2012, we're coming up to the period where the Limits to Growth study forecast a peak and decline in world industrial output. Now, I think this is actually exactly what we're seeing right now, and have been since 2008 or before. But the signals are being ignored or misinterpreted. I want to unpack those signals with you in the next few minutes using these three factors. Now, not all of them were discussed in the Limits to Growth scenario study. Energy and environment were, but not specifically climate change and not debt. There was a deliberate decision on the part of the authors of the study to exclude the financial system from consideration in the other more environmental factors. But as we've found during these past 4 years, you can't really do that. You can't exclude the financial system from our analysis. So we'll put that back in. First of all, energy. As I suggested earlier, energy is the driver of everything. Why? Because it takes energy to do literally everything we do. And if you have lots of cheap energy, you can do things that you couldn't do before. And that's basically what's happened to us over the past couple of 100 years. We've always used energy, but it previously had been in the forms of, you know, food and firewood. We'd exerted energy into our environment by way of muscle power, either human or animal. But with fossil fuels, we gained access to energy sources that had been produced over the course of tens of millions of years through processes into which we had to invest no effort whatsoever. highly concentrated, portable energy sources. Think about it this way. Maybe you've had the experience of running out of gas in your car and having to push your car 10 feet off to the side of the road. Now imagine pushing your car for, let's say, 25 or 30 miles. How much work is that? But it's a pretty fair estimate to say it's a couple of months of hard labor pushing your car 30 miles. Well, we get that done for us with a single gallon of gas for which we're paying less than $4 and complaining. You can't get labor that cheap anywhere on the planet. And of course, that's why we have mechanized every process of production and transport that we possibly could over the past few decades. And that's given us enormous economic growth. But oil, which is economically the most crucial of the fossil fuels because it represents virtually all of transport energy, oil, like the other fossil fuels, is non-renewable and depleting. We've learned that in this country. You know, this is where the oil industry started. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, we were the world's foremost oil exporting nation. More than half the world's oil was coming from oil fields in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas, California, places like that. But discoveries of oil reached a maximum around 1930 and have generally been declining since then. Actual production of oil, or extraction of oil, as I prefer to say, in the U.S., has been declining since 1970. We've had some good luck the last few years as a result of applying extraordinary technologies to low quality reservoirs in places like North Dakota. But we still have a long way to go to catch up to where we were in 1970, and we certainly won't get there. We won't see a new peak in U.S. oil production. Now, this same peaking and decline phenomenon that we've seen here in the U.S. is being mimicked in country after country around the world. Countries that used to be oil exporting nations are now oil importing nations: Indonesia, Great Britain. World oil discoveries have been declining since about 1964. So it's not just a couple of years of bad luck. This is a long-established trend. Actual world crude oil production has been flat since 2005. And that's in the context of very high oil prices. So there's every incentive for oil producers to bring as much to market as they possibly can. But again, actual production has stalled out. Why so? Well, it's because the oil industry has changed so much, so fast. This is what it looked like back in the 1930s. This is what it looks like today, when a single exploratory oil well in ultra-deep water can cost $500 million to drill and still come up dry. The industry needs high oil prices in order to justify applying these extraordinary new technologies to the kinds of reservoirs that are left, which are certainly not the best. We've gone about extracting fossil fuels using the low-hanging fruit principle. So we got the cheap, easy stuff early in the game. What's left is basically the dregs. So the industry needs high oil prices, and that's what we've been seeing. But high oil prices have an economic impact. And we've been seeing that since the 1970s, since the first oil crisis of 1973. Every time we've had an oil price spike, we've had a recession immediately follow.
Radio EcoShock.
We'll be right back with the rest of Richard Heinberg in Chicago on Life After Growth, Why the Economy is Shrinking, and What to Do About It.